Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. When NASA first formed in 1958 and recruited the first group of astronauts, the Mercury 7, the following year, there was a very basic mission: get a man in space as soon as possible. I say man because back then, all the astronauts were men. Once the Soviet Union beat us to that goal in 1961 with the flight of Yuri Gagarin, a new goal had to be set, and President Kennedy set it to go to the moon.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills.
But before that giant leap could happen, NASA needed more astronauts and needed to prove that it could fly humans safely in space, which brings us to our guest's place in history. Aerospace scientists knew they would need to provide some kind of specialized medical personnel to look after the astronauts, but who would fit that bill? It turns out it was an Air Force nurse named Dee O'Hara. Dee was one of the most respected persons in the entire space program. The astronauts and their families depended on her and trusted her. There are a lot of amazing things about Dee, including the stories she has to tell, but also consider this. She still goes to work for NASA every week at the Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California. The indefatigable nurse joined us from her home in the Bay Area. Dee O'Hara, it's an honor, and welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, I'm very flattered that you wanted to speak with me.
Well, I've known about your career for a very long time and always admired it, and it's a real pleasure for me. So I'd like to start with some origins with you. Tell us a bit about where you're from, where you grew up, and what your early family life was like. Give us a little background on where you're from.
Well, I was born in Nampa, Idaho, and I grew up in spent some time in California in very little time, but I really grew up in Oregon. I went to grade school and high school there, and then went to Portland, Oregon to take my nurse's training, and it was just a fun place to grow up.
And what made you decide that you wanted to pursue a career in nursing?
That's the $64,000 question. My mother was in the hospital one time, and I went in to see her. I was very young, and anyway, I got sick, and I had to go sit in the nurse's lounge because I was nauseated, which doesn't explain why I went into nursing. But in high school, we had a career day, and a nurse from Providence Hospital was there. And she was lovely in this white uniform, and I liked the looks of the nursing school. And sorry to say, that's kind of why I went into nursing. I just I was enthralled with the way the nursing school looked like and the white uniform.
Okay, let's talk a bit about how you came to NASA. So it's the late 1950s, 1957 in October, Sputnik is launched by the Soviet Union. Where are you at that time before NASA comes calling?
Well, went into the Air Force. My roommate came home one day and said, you know, we ought to join the Air Force, Nurse Corps, and go see the world. And my comment was, well, nice girls don't do that, which is kind of a ridiculous statement, but that's what I said. Anyway, we decided to join the Air Force, and so that's what we did. And I went to, after officers training school, I went to Patrick Air Force Base there in near Cocoa Beach, Florida, and that's where I was stationed. And when Sputnik and them went up, that's where I was.
Ah, and then NASA forms the next year, and they select the first group of astronauts. When do they come calling on you? How do you become a NASA nurse? How did that happen?
Well, it's kind of a long, drawn-out story, but like you said, the first seven were selected in April of 57, I believe, 1957.
I think it's 58.
And I was selected... 58, okay, yes, and I was selected in November of that year, and what happened was I was working in labor and delivery room I was working night shift, and I got a message the next when I got up that Colonel Knopf, who was the center commander of Patrick Air Force Base, wanted to see me when I got off duty. And of course, I was terrified because I knew there were only two reasons that you went to see Colonel Knopf. One was that you were in trouble, or two, you were getting a promotion. Well, I'd only been there 6 months at Patrick, so I knew it was not a promotion.
Oh, okay.
And so I kept thinking, gosh, I didn't remember dropping any babies or mistreating a mother. I couldn't figure out why I was summoned to see him. Went to his office that morning, and there sent the chief nurse and the executive officer and the commander of the hospital, and there were all these people in this room. And I came in, and he pointed to a chair and asked me to sit down, and of which I just sat on the very edge of it, because I was really very, very scared. And he started talking about NASA and astronauts, and that didn't mean anything to me. And he talked about the moon, and he talked about Mercury. And I knew, well, there was a planet named Mercury, and I knew there was Mercury in a thermometer. And that was the extent of my knowledge. Anyway, he was sitting there, and he had a big Zippo lighter in his hand, and he had a cigarette. He poked camels, I think, and he was banging the cigarette butt against the lighter. And he looked at me, and he said, "Well, do you want the job or not?"
And did you know what he was talking about? Did you?
No. And I turned around, and I looked behind me, and he when I turned around, he said, "You haven't heard a damn word I've said, have you?" And I said, "Well, no, sir." And he said, "Well, do you want the job or not?" And I said, "Well, I guess so," not having a clue of what I had agreed to. So when the meeting broke up, I went out in the hallway, and the chief nurse grabbed me, and she said, "Well," she said, "you're just as crazy as they are." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Well, they are talking about putting a man on top of a rocket and firing them off into space, and you have just agreed to become part of that group."
Oh, wow.
And I still was a little baffled, but that's how it happened. And so the next day I went into his execs officer and I said, "What happened? I mean, why me?" And he said, "Well, Colonel Knopf was in charge of putting together the medical teams for the support of Project Mercury for NASA. And he apparently had gone to Air Force headquarters and looked through all of the nursing files there, and because he decided that the astronauts needed to have a nurse, because he figured that pilots usually won't go to their flight surgeon because they don't want to be grounded.
Only two things can happen, and one of them's bad for pilots.
And one of them is bad. That's right. So he thought, well, maybe if we had a nurse there, she could pick up on anything that was wrong with them, and they might trust her. So he didn't find what he was looking for at headquarters. So he came back to Patrick, and apparently had looked through the files there and observed me for 2 weeks. I don't know what kind of observations he was looking for, and he said that's the one, and that's how it happened. I was bottom line. I was in the right place at the right time.
Wow. That's an amazing story, Dee. And just to correct myself earlier, NASA forms in 1958, and the astronauts are selected
right.
at the beginning of
1959.
And I know that because that's the year I was born, and I've always been...
Oh, my gosh. You are a youngster. Okay.
I'm just a child.
April of 59, and I was selected in November of 59.
All right, well, let's talk about once you become the nurse for the Mercury 7 astronauts, what was your first duties like? What did they have you doing right there in the beginning?
First of all the astronauts, the Mercury guys, were all stationed at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia, and they would fly down to the Cape Canaveral for training and that sort of thing. So my first job was to set up what we call the pre-flight exam area. And it was upstairs in building Hangar S, a great big old hangar. And on the second floor, there was a laboratory and an exam room and my office. And and a suit room where those famous silver spacesuits were housed. And then there was another little conference room. And in the back of that was what we called the crew quarters. It was just a room where we had bunk beds and that sort of thing, where they could spend the night if they got out of training, you know, late. And so my first job was to get that whole pre-flight area set up and operational, if you will, and working, and have it ready for either a flight or whenever the astronauts would come down for meetings and training.
Yeah. And okay, let's talk about the Mercury astronauts. And before we get into them individually, because I'll have you describe, some of your memories of them, but it's hard to convey to people now that aren't as old as I am and don't remember those days. It's hard to convey how big a phenomenon the Mercury 7 astronauts were at that time. Could you just give us some kind of sense and like when you realize these guys are becoming very famous?
It's going to be hard for me to, I think, explain it, but you're absolutely correct. It was, even I didn't realize the enormity of that program and of the guys. And I remember the first time they were all seven down there for a meeting, and they were all back in this little conference room. And for some reason, I happened to walk down the hall and open this door, and there they were. And it literally took my breath away, and I was terrified. And I said, oh, excuse me, and I slammed the door and ran out. And John Glenn came up to my office and said, well, come back and meet the guys. And so I did, but it was very intimidating, because I was, 23 years old or 22 or 23 years old. And these guys were, every time you turned around, pictures were in the paper, they were on the TV news and that sort of thing. And I was in total awe of them for quite a while until I really got to know them.
And you did really get to know them, didn't you?
Very much so. Yes.
Let's talk about them. I'm just going to bring them up one at a time, and whatever comes to mind. So I'll just go in the order that they flew. Let's start with Alan Shepard. And I always think of that famous picture of just before his flight of Alan Shepard with the thermometer sticking up at an angle out of his mouth as he's getting his temperature taken. Were you the one that stuck that thermometer in there?
Probably. It was either myself or Bill Douglas. Dr. Bill Douglas was their NASA flight surgeon. Alan was a very interesting person. He was very smart and very capable. Well, all of them are very smart and very capable. But Alan was not the warm and friendly type. You had to really get to know him, and he had to really get to know you. But he was known as the Icy Commander.
The Icy Commander.
Because he had these steel blue eyes, and boy, he could bore holes right through you. And he loved nothing more than to quiz you about something and watch you squirm if you didn't have the answer. But he was an interesting personality. We finally got along very well.
Yeah, and he was, of course, America's first astronaut in space.
Yes.
For 15 minutes in May of 1961. Okay, next up, Gus Grissom, the late, great Gus Grissom.
Gus was very, very quiet. He is not into small talk. He preferred to just talk airplanes. And he was a very nice guy, but I never really got to know. Let's say I never got really close to him because he really didn't allow people to get close to him unless you were another pilot, or because he liked to just talk airplanes. But he was very capable, and I don't know what else to say because I didn't interact with him as much as I did with the others.
But before we go on any further, do you remember where you were and what it was like on that terrible day in January of 1967 when he was killed?
The fire?
When he was killed in the fire with Roger Chaffee and Ed White?
Yes, I certainly do. I think that happened on a Friday, mm-hmm. Thursday or Friday. And I was scheduled to go down to the Cape on Monday to start setting up and getting ready for the pre-flight physicals. So I was over in the laundry room. I lived in this apartment house, and I was in the laundry room doing my laundry, which was an every Friday night event. And when it came over the speaker that was in the laundry room, and I thought I had misheard. So I went back to my apartment, and then, of course, the phone was ringing off the hook, and it was the news media calling about the fire. That was a terrible, terrible day for everyone.
Yes, yes. One of the worst days ever for NASA. Okay, back to happier subjects. You've mentioned him before, probably the most famous of all the Mercury 7 astronauts, John Glenn.
John Glenn. Well, John was, what you saw was what you got. I mean, John was super friendly, always had a big smile, dimples and freckles on his face. And John was a super, super friendly guy. It just wasn't a hail, well-met type of guy, but he was very sincere. And he generally, you know, he kind of liked everybody. He was a very friendly guy and very approachable. You could approach him.
I thought it was very fitting into his character that he was the one that came up and got you to bring you back down to meet the guys.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, he did. He was the first one. And that was the kind of guy that John was. He kind of was inclusive, if you will. He mm-hmm. included everybody.
Okay, how about Scott Carpenter?
Well, Scott was the dreamer. Scott was a lovely, lovely man. He was very scientifically oriented. He was in interested in everything. And he was interested, if he was talking to you, he wanted to know all about you. And he had a depth of knowledge of number of things. But a very sensitive, almost not poetic, I want to say, but just very sensitive. And he cared deeply about people and his family and his friends. Super guy, super guy.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with NASA's first nurse, Dee O'Hara. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to my interview with Dee O'Hara. Dee was hired by NASA in 1959 to be the first space nurse for the original Mercury astronauts and went on in that capacity through the Apollo program. I know this one was, from all my understanding, was a very dear friend of yours, Wally Schirra.
Oh, my goodness. Wally. Yes, that guy was unbelievable. I loved Wally very well. I loved all of them, but Wally and I really connected, and he was a true jokester and a punster. He was a master of puns, believe me, but super friendly guy, and loved nothing better than to play tricks on you and harass you a bit, but all in good fun. Yeah, he was a super guy.
Did he really give you a 5-gallon container for a urine sample once?
Oh, I wasn't going to bring that up, but yes.
Oh, come on.
We had to collect 24-hour urine samples. And so the guys would, but Wally particularly would leave, he wouldn't turn his sample into the lab, which was next to my office. He had to put his up on top of a air conditioning and a radiator type of thing. We had these old bathrooms in Hangar S. I mean, and they were really ancient. And he would climb up, and I had to climb up on the commode and on the back of this metal racket there to reach the sample. And then they were to write the time that they voided. Well, Wally had to write his in Greenwich Mean Time. I barely understood military time, let alone Greenwich Mean Time. But he took great delight in doing that. And so, yes, one morning I came in, and there sitting on my desk was one of these huge, you know, what the I don't know if they're 5-gallon, whatever they are.
Sparklets water bottle that you'd put in,
yes,
a water
exactly.
cooler.
Exactly. Great. From a water cooler, right. There it was. And it was the right color, foam on the top, and he had stuffed a bouquet of lollipops in the top of the jug and streamers down it, and, you know, to D with love from Wally.
That is classic.
For some reason, when I walked in, I went over, I have no idea why I did, and I felt it, and it was nice and warm. So, of course, that meant it was, well, what he had done was taken hot water and tincture of benzoin and a little to give it color, and a little bit of Tide soap to give it the foam on the top. So, yes, that was quite the sample.
That, I love that story. That's why they called him Jolly Wally.
Jolly Wally, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, what about Gordon Cooper?
Gordon was a fun guy and very, very friendly, and loved his Oklahoma drawl. And he was a neat guy. He loved race cars, and he loved to drive fast. Of course, all of them are pretty much like to drive fast, but Gordon particularly. But he was a true hot dog pilot, if you will. He would try most anything. But he was a super guy and very friendly, and just a nice guy.
And then finally, a man who did not get to fly on Project Mercury, but did become the head of the astronaut corps,
right.
Deke Slayton.
Tell us
about Deke.
Gorgeous guy. I remember the first time I met, he was the first astronaut I met. I was out with Colonel Knopf. This is before I went to set up the pre-flight area. And we were kind of standing, there was this huge crowd around him. And I remember Colonel Knopf saying, well, this is Deke Slayton. And I knew the name, and I almost got a whiplash whirling around just to look at him. But Deke was a very quiet, very stoic guy, but had a wonderful, droll sense of humor. And he was all business, very honest, and he made a great chief of the astronaut office, believe me. And the guys had tremendous respect for him, because not only was he knowledgeable about what was going on, but he was very honest with all of them, and they trusted him explicitly. He was a tremendous, tremendous guy, and it was very sad when he got bumped from his flight.
Because he had a heart fibrillation, right?
He had atrial fib, yeah. And at that time, you know, we were just, we had no idea what the stresses of space or weightlessness would do to the body. Didn't have a clue. There was no way to check it out. So that's why, rather than risk his life with the atrial fib, they decided, obviously, as you know, to cancel his mission.
Okay, well, let's talk about those flights, those early flights, the Mercury flights. Did you have an inkling there, when you first got started, as to how dangerous this really was? Because it truly was dangerous.
Yes, it was. I had no idea, and I was terrified each time they went, because it wasn't the guy I was worried about. It was the damn rocket that they were going to be on. Was this, you know, because they'd launched I don't know how many Atlas missiles, and it would go up and curve over and go right back in the ocean. And so my fear was that there would be an on the pad explosion or a bore or something. And I was never worried about what their capability, but I sure didn't have that much faith in the machinery.
Okay, could you walk us through, like for a flight like John Glenn's or any of the orbital flights, Wally's would be great. Walk us through what your role was during one of those early Mercury flights. What did you have to do?
Well, depending on the launch time, I would sometimes I spent the night out at the Cape, and I was would call. The suit techs and that people to wake them up, if you will. And so once the astronaut was awake and it was his flight, he would shower and come in, and we would do the physical. Sometimes, if you can believe, I would draw we took blood samples before their flight. And usually we would have a lab tech from Patrick Air Force Base come out to do that, because that's what they're trained to do as a phlebotomist. Well, the poor guy, they would come out to do that, and they were so nervous having to take the guy's blood, that they just shook something terrible. So finally the guy said, no, we'll have Dee would do it. Well, I wasn't experienced. I could certainly do it, but that wasn't my fool. So a lot of times I would go and take their blood sample, and then we would do the physical. They would then go next door to get into their suit and leave to go out to the pad. And then I would clean up the area, and then I would go over. And during the first couple of flights, I went to the area near Culver's. It was in the, I guess it was called the Snark, where the Snark missile was. Anyway, I would just be there until after the launch and saying my rosary.
Ah, yes. And then once the flight is over, then what's your role then? Did you have to go to the recovery ship sometimes, or were you always?
No.
Did you always stay there?
Prior to Alan's flight, I was tasked to go down to Grand Bahama Island, GBI, to set up a small flyaway hospital. And that was where the suborbital flights, Alan and Gus would come following recovery and to get their physical. So as soon as Alan launched, I and Bill Douglas and whomever, and Deke Slayton and a few would get on board one of the aircrafts there at Patrick and fly down to GBI and wait for their recovery. And we'd go, and then down there we would do their physical and debriefing and that sort of thing.
And I would imagine collecting that data pre-flight and post-flight, since, like you mentioned before, nobody had ever done this before, flown in space.
No.
That was really important medical data to get.
Well, it really was, because it kind of set the basis, if you will, for ongoing flights, and it built the database, if you will, for the longer flights, because the information was truly invaluable, because this was never been done before. So it was all brand new numbers, if you will, of what the rigors of weightlessness and the stresses of G-forces on the body.
Yeah, and from all accounts and some firsthand that I've heard from astronauts and flight directors that we both know, the astronauts really trusted you. And you needn't name a name or anything like that, but can you think of an example of, you know, somebody coming to you with something that would be an example of that level of trust?
Yes. Well, I had made a deal with them, all of them, kind of right from the beginning, that they could come to me with whatever, and I would never betray them. Ever. But if they came to me, and in my opinion, it was the problem or situation that would jeopardize not only them, but the flight, then morally and legally, I would have to tell the flight surgeon. And they understood that. So they did come to me with a number of things. And one came one time, and he said he had blood in his urine. And he said, this was before his flight. And I thought, oh my God. So I had him leave me a sample. I took it into a local hospital there in Cocoa Beach and under my name and had them run a urinalysis. And as it was okay. There wasn't any problem. And I think what happened was there was some sort of a snapback. They wore a condom in order to avoid during flight.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some reason the device clamped down and during training, and that's what caused the few drops of blood. So there was no issue, and since the urine was clear, there were no blood cells, nothing was wrong. No one ever knew about it. So it's similar. Not a lot, but a couple of things like that.
Yeah, I imagine. Okay, and you also treated their families, didn't you?
Yes, I was, let me tell you, I was busy.
I bet.
Yes, when I resigned my commission, because some of the guys had come to me and said, well, we're going to be moving to Houston and we'd like you to stay with us. So would you, but you're going to have to resign your commission if you to do that. And I said, okay. So anyway, I resigned my commission. And so they got me hired. They hired me on an emergency basis in order to get the flight medicine clinic set up in Houston. And then, which I did. And by that time, the families were starting to migrate and move to the Houston area. So once they got there, then we the flight surgeons and myself, we took care of the families and the kids. We essentially became their family doctors, if you will.
Yeah.
And at that time, NASA had, it was in the NASA charter that we were to take care of the families and children because the astronauts would be gone so much and, you know, traveling to the various contractors and they were just gone all the time, it seemed like. And so the families had to have some place for medical care. They had to have some place to go. And so they were allowed to come to the flight medicine clinic. So yes, I worked very, very closely with all of the families. And so at one point I had over 500 patients, if you will.
Wow. And so things are really ramping up through the 60s with Project Gemini. When did it really dawn on you that this is actually going to happen and America is going to land an astronaut, one of your astronauts, on the moon?
Well, it was, I think, towards the end of Gemini and the beginning of the Apollo program, and everybody was in a, I don't want to say a fever pitch, but everybody was really busy and working hard. And then it was, again, it's kind of slowly, all of a sudden you realized what the heck was going on, even though you were right in the middle of it. I wasn't that conscious of it all the time. But it suddenly hits you that, hey, this is really happening. Now, I didn't think about it from a historical standpoint at all. It was just going to happen. And I don't know.
In the middle of history, it's hard to think of it in that context.
Exactly. I never really, it didn't even dawn on me that this was history making. Consciously, I didn't think about it. And it just suddenly was, and suddenly the flight was there. It was suddenly Apollo 11, and it was time to go.
Did you have much of a role during flights, or was it just, you know, before they left and when they got back?
Just before, yeah, it was definitely before they left, and then definitely when they came back. But during the flight, I would, some of the earlier flights, I would stay at the Cape because they were short flights, and I would stay at the Cape and be there for the post-flight physical and stuff. But for the longer missions, I would go back to Houston, you know, because we still had other astronauts coming in that weren't on assigned to a flight for physicals and families and that sort of thing.
If you're just joining us, our guest is the first nurse of the space program, Dee O'Hara. Dee was responsible for helping to provide medical care to the first groups of astronauts and their families. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our interview with Dee O'Hara. Dee was the nurse for the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts and their families. There's one very famous story. I'm wondering if you know any inside information about it, or memories, really, because we know kind of the inside story already. It's Apollo 13 and the measles, with Charlie Duke's son, Tom, had the measles. And then, so he, you know, and Charlie had not had the measles. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. Very well.
Tell us about that.
Charlie got exposed due to his son. And then, of course, he exposed Ken Mattingly and the others. And so that was when we started what we call the Flight Crew Health Stabilization Program. And that's when the X number of days before, I think 21 days before the flight, the crew was quarantined. And those of us who were to work with them, we had to have physicals, we had to have our shots up to date, and we had to be medically cleared to go near them. And the astronauts had to stay in quarters in order to protect themselves. And of course, with the measles thing, that was a very devastating thing, especially for Ken Mattingly, because Ken, we had all of our, had blood samples taken to check our titer. And the concern was that if they launched, and since Ken was exposed, he would have been on the backside of the moon and out of voice contact. And they did, you know, and he could have become ill. So yeah. Ken was scrubbed from that flight. And of course, Jack Schweigert, his backup, went in his place. And what I vividly remember is I was at the Cape and Ken came in and asked me, he said, have you heard, am I going to get scrubbed? And I had not heard at that time. Shortly thereafter, Ken got the word that he was off the flight. And it was a pretty blue day that day.
Yeah.
He was devastated, and rightfully so. And poor Jack Schmidt was in a state of shock because he was going to be launched in 2 or 3 days.
Jack Schweigert.
Yeah, Jack Schweigert, yes, because he was, and he was the backup pilot. And the interesting thing is that Jack had written the emergency procedures for that flight.
Yeah, in a way, it all worked out quite beautifully because
it did. It really did.
Jack Schweigert performed beautifully during Apollo 13.
He did.
He was a very healthy, robust guy. And in those conditions, as you recall, it was so cold in the spacecraft, you know, day after day. And Fred Hayes got very ill.
Well, Fred was very, very sick when he got back. And then, as it turned out, as you just said, Ken got, I think he was on, what, 16?
16,
Ken got a beautiful flight, you know, it worked well.
With Charlie Duke, you know, Charlie Duke taketh away and then he giveth. So, yeah.
I know. But yes, it was, that was kind of a bum day. But I think if you ever want a true example of teamwork, it's the Apollo 13 ground crew, the flight crews, the mission control. You talk about teamwork. Everybody piled in and did what they could to get those guys back home. And I've always thought of when you hear, well, we need teamwork or whatever, there's the classic example of true teamwork.
Legendary,
yes.
Just tell us a bit about, you know, once, like Neil Armstrong, and maybe you could comment on him a little bit because he's probably the most famous astronaut for most people. When he first set foot on the moon and you realized that John F. Kennedy's goal had been met, you know, Apollo had accomplished this incredible mission, what did that feel like for you at that time? Or were you just too busy? Just it was like all a whir.
Well, all of those things you said, they hit me afterwards. They certainly didn't at the time, I guess, because
you're in the middle of it.
You were in the middle of it. And each one of those things that you just mentioned were definitely the goals had been met and we actually did it. But at the time, it just didn't, I don't know quite how to say it. I was aware of it. I don't know. I just didn't recall. It just didn't hit me like it probably should have or like it did a short while later. But Neil was a very, very interesting man and very quiet and a classic. I know he's legendary modesty. I mean, Neil was a very modest guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the classic example to me of that was Neil came over for this was the day before launch. He came over for his pre-flight, and we were walking back across the causeway. And I said, Neil, I said, you will not believe how many people are out there to see your flight. I said, it's just The ground has sunk, I'm sure, 3 inches just from all the weights of the trailers and the cars and the people and the whatever. They're just to see the launch. And I said, it's unbelievable. And he turned to me and he said, well, I suppose people are going to make a big deal out of this. I said, Neil, do you realize what you just said? I said, of course they're going to make a big deal. But that was Neil. It was just, this was his flight. It was his job. And it was no big deal to him.
Yeah. Well, and he also had a very, very dry sense of humor. So there was
probably
a little bit of that in there, too. Any other of the Apollo astronauts that, you know, stand out in your mind that you became perhaps close with?
Well, yeah, Gene Cernan, particularly, was on, you know, Apollo 17. And Gene and I were very, very close friends. It was a great flight. And, of course, Ron Evans was, they were a super crew. They really were. And Gene was responsible for my going on the round the world tour with the Apollo 17 crew and their families. You know, after the flight, the White House would send the crew on a round the world trip to the various countries and stuff. And anyway, so Gene was responsible for my being on that trip with them.
After the last lunar mission, Apollo 17, what was that like, traveling around the world with those famous men?
It was an unbelievable experience, as you can well imagine. And we kind of talked about, we probably went to countries that you would never normally get to go to. I mean, like, you know, Naomi and Lagos, Nigeria. And it was a wonderful, wonderful trip. And what was amazing was you'd be out in the middle of this jungle, if you will, and the crew were in kind of a Jeep type, open Jeep type, so that the people and the crowds were amazing. And they would jump up and point to the moon. And somehow they knew that those three guys that they were looking at had just been to the moon. And they were so excited. And these were areas that I don't know how much communication, if any, that they had, but they knew who these three guys were. We always kind of found that astonishing.
And how long did you stay in Houston working with the astronauts before you semi-retired and moved on?
Abandoned ship?
Yeah.
Well, I went there in, 64 or 65 when they opened the center. And I left in December of 73 when I transferred out to Ames Research Center.
And what did you do there at Ames?
Well, when I transferred out, I was so burnt out and tired.
Oh, I bet.
And a lot of my favorite people, you know, the Staffords and Bormans and all, you know, so many of my favorite wives particularly they were all moving on, and I needed a different break. So I was fortunate in order to get what they call a lateral transfer, and they don't usually do lateral transfers on people in my low level of job. So when I arrived, they put me as manager of the human research facility, which is like a 12-bed metabolic, you know, it was like a miniature hospital. And what we did was to put test subjects to bed for X number of days as a way of simulating weightlessness. And so I was in charge of that and putting the experiments together and putting a staff together and seeing that the experiment was successful.
And even to this day, you go in there to work for a couple of days a week, don't you?
Let's don't use the word work. That's kind of used loosely. Yes, I go 2 days a week or 2 mornings a week, let me put it that way. And the facility is closed now, and I work for the chief medical officer. And where we handle all the medical records and stuff for our human test subjects that are doing sleep studies and various ground research work. And so I just go 2 mornings a week. It gives me something to do.
And of course, we're at the kind of the 50-year mark now from Apollo 17 this coming December. Hard to believe, but during anniversaries, the last few years, like in 2019 with Apollo 11, what's that been like for you? As you see, you know, everyone looking back at that time and knowing you were in the midst of it, what's that perspective like for you now as you look back and knowing its history?
I think I probably appreciate it more. Every year that a year goes by, I appreciate more and think about how terribly lucky and fortunate I was to have been selected in the right place at the right time and been exposed to not only these people, but all of the places and people and things that to celebrate these flights.
You know, the Mercury astronauts, again, were so famous, and there's been movies made about, there's The Right Stuff, two versions of The Right Stuff, one that was even made recently about those guys that you knew so well, and of course the film Apollo 13. I don't know if you've seen them or not, but when you see those kinds of portrayals for people you actually know, what is that like?
It's awful.
In what way?
Well, I have a hard time. There was one made member of the Wives Club or something like that, and that was just dreadful. I mean, that was awful, awful. Yeah, the original
Astronauts Wives Club, yeah.
Wives Club, and it was just awful because what bothered me most about it was that this is the perception that the public has of the wives, and it's just, it couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, it was just a dreadful TV program. The movie of The Right Stuff was kind of fun and fascinating. I mean, all producers or directors, I think, take poetic license in some stuff.
Sure.
And it was kind of interesting to watch. But I don't watch a lot of them because Tom Hanks did, what was it, From Earth to Moon, or he did a series.
Yes,
and
From the Earth
I tried
to
watch it, but I didn't know who. I had a heck of a time. I didn't know who these people were. Unless they said a name, because they didn't look like the people they were portraying.
Right. Mark Harmon, as great as he is, did not look like Wally Schirra.
No, he did not. He did not. And I just, and they were talking about Walt Williams and Deke Slayton, and, you know, they mentioned all these names, and I didn't have a clue of who the hell they were talking about, because, I mean, I knew the names, but I didn't know who the, so it was a total wipeout for me. It was a total bust. I didn't enjoy it at all, because I didn't know who anybody was.
Yeah, you would recognize the real people, but not actors playing
well,
them.
Well, you see, that was it. The Right Stuff, they were came a little closer, because, you know, Ed Harris did look a lot like John Glenn, and I was trying to think of Lance Hendricks, I think, was to play Wally. And they did a little more trying to match the actor to the astronaut. But other than that, the other things were just, they were awful.
Well, it's been just a delight to talk to you. And again, looking back, you know, 50 years ago, you were in the midst of this. If you were going to point to what your favorite part of it was, and I can imagine what it would be, but what was your favorite part of being the astronaut's nurse?
Boy, that's kind of a tough question. I think maybe getting to know the astronauts so well and becoming... They allowed me to be a part of their family. It wasn't something that I earned or worked for, but so being able to be as close to them as I was, and fortunately still am to some, that's probably been the greatest part. And all the memories, because thank God for memories, because those they can't take away from you.
Yeah. And you've mentioned a couple of these commemorative celebrations at 50 years. When you go to things like this, do you find that, you know, people know who you know, oh yeah, that's Dee O'Hara, the astronaut nurse. Do they know who you are and want your autograph and stuff like that?
And that's the most astonishing part. I don't understand why or how they know all this. They're obviously avid space fans. You have to be. I mean, I don't know, how did you know my name? I mean, that has always baffled me.
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. I'm a space historian. I lived through that time. I remember you as a child. You know, it was like, oh yeah, Dee O'Hara. She's their nurse. You know, I wish she was giving me this shot instead of this other lady.
God knows I've done enough of those. But no, I still get requests for autographs and stuff through the mail. In fact, I just got one a couple of days ago, wanted me to sign some cards and stuff. But I'm just amazed that people know who I am. I mean, I don't understand it. And it's wonderful. And I'm very grateful that even you know who I am. But I keep saying, well, who am I? I mean, I just don't get it. It's very nice, and I'm very extremely flattered. You have no idea how flattered I am, but it's baffling to me. Believe me, it is baffling.
Well, the fact that it's baffling to you is what makes us just, that's why we love you. You're great. You're awesome.
Well, it's been quite a ride, my dear, let me tell you.
Thanks again to our guest, Nurse Dee O'Hara. I asked my friend Amy Bean, daughter of the fourth man to walk on the moon, Alan Bean, if she remembered Dee as her nurse. Her reply was, yes, I saw her all the time because I had lots of ear infections. And when I asked Dee if she remembered little Amy, she did and remembered her with fondness. I'll leave it with what Amy had to say about Dee O'Hara. She's a terrific nurse and a great person. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynsbr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. The theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.